For those that may be absent. So we have been looking at the residency schedule, and since we are ahead of schedule, we made the call as a group to end residency early. So you're welcome. April 29th, the last Friday in April, will be our last day. Okay? So we're ending, what is that, 2 weeks early? Yes, 2 weeks early. Okay? That is also April 29th, our graduation day. Okay? So we had it on like May 28th. Some of you guys were going to be out of town anyway, so we figured it was six and one half days of the other. So we're just going to call it. You've got a month and a half. So that night, from 6 to 8, 6 to 9, we will go have dinner together as a group. So we're working on location and all that. But if you'll just book that, we'll have dinner after work that night, 6 to 9, just book as a group. Okay? It'll be dinner plus one, so you guys can all bring a date or a spouse or a date that's going to turn into a spouse or whatever. That'll be your first date, so yes. You're welcome. So Friday, April 29th, last day of residency and the day of our celebration dinner, okay? The test will be after that. So we will give you guys, prior to that date, the name of the proctor who is going to administrate your exam or proctor your exam, okay? So you'll be given a name. We'll give you about a 2 to 3 week window to take the final, okay? Which means you need to call, set up an appointment. We'll give you all the parameters of the test. It's going to be 2.5 hours or so that you'll need to take it, okay? So you'll just set up a time with said individual. It'll be same sex, so there won't be any of that awkwardness, just FYI. So guys with guys, girls with girls. So we had a couple years where somehow we got like a boss at the well doing one for their subordinate, so we won't do any of that either, okay? So just to make anything not awkward in that realm as well, okay? So you'll set the time up. You'll take the test at your convenience with them, and then you'll report back to us. Actually, we'll give you the whole structure, but that test will go to Patty. Patty will grade them, and we'll give you guys results, okay? So that's the process. Is there anybody that's like, man, April 29th is a disaster for me? I'll be skydiving or something they otherwise cannot get out of. Okay. So if you got something, you got something. We're going to lose a few on the 28th. So do what you can, Judson, obviously, but works. I mean, if you gotta work, then that is what it is. So no sweat. Okay. What am I smelling? Food wise, smells good. Sorry. That wasn't like, ooh, what am I smelling? Something smells good. Are you cooking? Like, while you're not even cooking, you're cooking? How is it possible? Yes. No. It's got to be you. Am I the only one that smells this? Oh, it's your breakfast. How rude. Did you bring enough for the rest of us, Amy? Okay. So, that's we all square on that? All right. So, look forward to the party. 29th will be our last day. Cool?
Has anyone gotten a perfect score?
Oh, yeah. We've had,
you know, that's 25 more days of waking up.
You sound like my then 3-year-old. How many more sleeps is that, Daddy? That's how we had to measure things.
Ten
more sleeps till Christmas.
Do it.
But you're like the opposite. You look to noon wake-ups. We'll throw some bonus questions on there. I think our highest score was like 108. So, Brianne Cadieu. So, yeah. You guys know Brianne. She's sneaky smart. Yeah. She studied hard and did well. So, because her salvation depends on it. So, look if you know. All right. 2 Samuel. Let's jump back in, shall we? Let me pray for us, and then we'll dive into the text. Lord, thanks for this morning. And God, as we, just with March and life and spring, we do feel a little bit on the downhill side of this thing, and I'm grateful for these individuals who've made such a big commitment. God, I pray that you would help us to finish strong, that we would not be weary. God, I know we got a lot of life going on with school and work and just responsibilities of life that affect all of us. So God, I pray that you would just give us strength to finish well. And I pray again as we started that is we're in your text every day and so reading through all of this at such a pace it can be quick, Father, that we would not be concerned just about our heads, but our hearts as well, and that we continue to change at that level. Lord, and as we look at a guy today that did that on so many levels, both good and bad, Father, as we look at David's life and see the impact that a walk with you had, Father, I pray that you would again teach us from him. As we see a guy that has just a magnanimous personality, who is gracious beyond belief, and yet, Lord, is going to make some really stupid decisions in his walk with you, Father, I pray that you would teach us from all of them. So, God, we love you. We're grateful for the time to study your word, the freedom that we have to do it, the gift that it is to be able to open your word, Father, we recognize this morning. In Christ's name, amen. All right. Well, we are in Camelot, right? We are in that season of David's reign where we are seeing him blessed beyond belief. We'll continue kind of that theme today. He spent a lot of time waiting for this period in his life to be finally given to him. Kind of officially in 2 Samuel chapter 5, we saw the southern kingdom of Judah finally kind of, or Israel finally kind of follow on the heels of the guys in Judah that gave them the kingdom. David takes Jerusalem finally in 2 Samuel 5 verse 7 as his capital, moves from Hebron there, which had been the place where Saul ruled from, to kind of unite all the kingdoms. So by the time we get there, we're seeing David reign over an entire kingdom, both north and south, is really Israel's greatest ever king, and is beginning to obviously make a name for himself within the kingdom. We made some observations kind of in our way through this about David and maybe some of the compromises that we're seeing thus far in his life. What have you guys seen? What do you remember with David that you just go, maybe not like, gosh, like red level, like Samson disobedience, but certainly stuff that makes you scratch your head. Yeah, all his wives. How many did we count? It's like 8 or 10. I said maybe as many as like 15. Like, he's acquiring wives. Again, what was the purpose of that? Why did you acquire multiple wives? What was the half-full version of that? Yeah, alliances with the people around you. Okay, so we're seeing that. What else do you guys see? Anything else that we've made note of so far? I don't know that there's been a ton of stuff yet. We're going to see a couple other things this morning that'll make you go, how about chapter 6? I guess there was kind of a head-scratcher in there in regards to the ark. What did we make mention of as we were talking about David bringing the ark back? He didn't follow the guidelines the first time he did it. That ended poorly, especially if you're a guy by the name of Uzzah, right? He died because of David's disobedience. So the zeal and knowledge piece. What else in regards to the ark? The tabernacle, yeah, which was like next door, and yet in Gibeon, he just doesn't do it. And he builds his own tent for the tabernacle, or for the ark, rather, instead of reuniting it with the tabernacle. Could have been such a beautiful love song we could have sang, reunited. But no, David ruins it all for us, okay? So we don't get that. So you're seeing a couple of things that just make you go, man, I don't understand. Why is he not being that way? Yet in 2 Samuel 7, we see the Davidic covenant. We talked about this last week, the sense that, man, God's behind this guy, right? He calls him a man after his own heart. He promises, as David desires to build it for God, a physical house. God says, thank you very much, but I would prefer me to build you a house, an everlasting house. And we see this idea of there will be an individual on the throne forever that comes from Judah. We know that ultimately to be Jesus Christ, the Messiah of the Old Testament, our Savior in the New Testament. That's going to come from there. God says, hey, thanks. I appreciate your heart, but I don't want a house, right? And we talked about the whole idea of that forward. Now, God's going to allow the house to be built that Solomon ultimately is going to have control over and build. David will not be allowed to do that. Chronicles tells us it's because he's a man of bloodshed. And that David isn't allowed to build it, but it seems that God doesn't really want this from the get-go, very similar to the king's system in Israel. God says, man, you don't want it. I'll allow you to have it, but this ultimately is not my desire, okay? So we left off, and midway through, I guess, 2 Samuel 7, we finished 17 with this kind of response from God about the Davidic covenant, and then in 18 and following, we see David's now response to God regarding what God said to him. Now, I just want you to notice this in context, how David hears this, okay? God very clearly said, hey, I'm going to bless your socks off, and David understands that. 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. Somebody pick up there.
Then King David went in and sat before the Lord and said, who am I, O Lord God, and what is my house that you have brought me thus far? And yet this was a small thing in your eyes, O Lord God. You have spoken also of your servant's house for a great while to come, and this is instruction for mankind, O Lord God.
Okay, so my text says concerning your distant future, So how does David hear God's response to his desire to build him a physical house? What is David talking about here? A temple? Why, O Lord, in what is my house that you have brought me thus far? And yet, if this was insignificant in your eyes, you have spoken also of my house, of your servant concerning his distant future. What does David hear God say? Are we talking about a temple? The answer is no. Everybody say no. No, we're talking about David's enduring house, right? His line, his lineage, his legacy. David understands what God said to mean, I'm going to build you a future. It's going to start with your son, and there's going to be a line of people that are coming. And David says, man, I was just talking about a house, a physical house. You're talking about a lineage. You're talking about building me a lifetime worth of the people that are going to sit on your throne that come from me. So David gets that, and he's overwhelmed. Again, what more can David say to you? Verse 20, for you know your servant, O God. And this whole piece is like a psalm written by David in the midst of 2 Samuel regarding what David has seen God do for him. We won't read all of it, but you just get bits and pieces of it. It's just David's response of praise to God. Verse 22, for this reason, you are great, O God. There is none like you. There is no God beside you, according to all that we have heard with our ears. And again, you see this theme in David's life. This is what we don't see. There is no idolatry. There's none like you, God. You are it. What nation on earth is like your people? Verse 23, whom God went to redeem for himself and to make a name for himself. That name is the word Shem. You remember way back in Genesis, God called Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's three sons. Shem literally means a name. I'm going to make a name for myself, right? So same word there, okay? So again, all of the rest of chapter 7 is about God, David's response to God about this house that he's going to get. So David hears this, and yet he's going to build a house anyway, or at least he's going to draw up the blueprints and get all the plans together and all the stuff required to build the house, okay? Now, that's the end of that. So turn to now to chapter 8. And let's see, again, in the midst of Camelot, watch what God is doing, okay? Notice real quick, I'm sorry, before you flip over, what is God's promise, by the way, to David? Read somebody chapter 7, 9 through 11, and just listen to what God promises that he's going to do in David's immediate future.
7? Mm-hmm. 9 through 11?
Mm-hmm. So what's God promising to David and Israel immediately? Someone just said it.
Peace,
right? God's saying, I'm going to give you peace on all sides. Even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares that the Lord will build a house for you. And he goes on from there. So he promises rest. Now, 8 verse 1 and following, this is what God does. Pick up there. Pause right there for me. Yours says Metha what?
Mine did,
okay, mine says chief city, all right, which is probably Gath. I've never heard that. What version are you reading out of?
ESV.
Okay, interesting. Anybody have a note on that? Like, is it same as Gath?
It's otherwise unknown. Perhaps it refers to a type of land after the time of David. There are no references to battles with the Philistines until the time of Hezekiah.
Okay, interesting. All right, so they take Philistine control. So which, obviously they're pushing them back to the coast. If they're taking their chief cities, I mean, we're way over. Are you with me? So David is winning territories. We just a couple chapters ago saw Saul battling people in the Judah Mountains, battling the Philistines. It was bad, so David's pushing them back. So he's at peace with the Philistines. Now, have they historically been a people that God has said, man, absolutely, go to work against them? Yeah, like that's been a foe, and God says, yeah, take, you can push them out of the land, if you will, okay? Verse 2, he defeated Moab and measured them with a line, making a line down the ground. He measured two lines and put to death He measured two lines to put to death and one full line to keep alive. So he put basically all the people of Moab in rows. Two of the rows he killed, one of the rows he kept. And the Moabites became servants to David, bringing tribute. Now, what do you guys remember about recently in some of our stories with Moab and David specifically? You guys remember when Saul was after him and David was about to like lose his mind and he was fearful of his family dying? Where did he send his family?
To Moab.
And then David takes over Moab, and then he does what to 2/3 of their people? Kills them. And then does what to the other third? Forced labor. Okay? Turn real quick to Deuteronomy chapter 2. Verse 9. This is when Joshua is about to walk into the land. Eric Castillo, read 2:9, and this is what God says to Joshua in regards to Moab. Deuteronomy. You got it. All right, so what did God tell Joshua in regard to Moab? Can you take their land? No. Why? This is pretty big. God doesn't just say, leave them alone. I, God, have given them that land as a possession. Joshua, you may not have it. What did David just do? Took Moab. Look at verse 12 of chapter 8, back to 2 Samuel. From Aram and Moab and the sons of Ammon and the Philistines and Amalek and the spoil of Hadadezer, whatever his name is, David made a name for himself in verse 13 when he returned from killing 18,000 Arameans or Edomites, which is the name that's mentioned in verse 14. He put garrisons in Edom. In all Edom he put garrisons, and the Edomites became servants to David, and the Lord helped David wherever he went. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 2. God says in verse 9, don't take Moab. Verse 19, when you come opposite the sons of Ammon, do not harass nor provoke them. I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot as a possession. These are the cities, these are the nations on the east side of the Jordan River. You guys remember that? Moab, Edom, Ammon, south to north, as Israel would have rolled through. So God says regarding Moab, don't take their stuff, don't take their land. I've given it to them as a possession. God says to Ammon, or to the Ammonites in regards to them, I've also given it to them as a possession. Edom is in here somewhere. I forget where. Anyway, God says the same thing of Edom. What is God doing, or what is David doing? He's taking all the land that God told Joshua not to take. Did God change his mind? I don't think so. But here's what's conflicting. What does it say at the end of verse 14 of 2 Samuel 8?
And the Lord gave victory to David wherever.
How do you interpret that? David is completely conflicting to me now. I don't know what to do with this. God said to Joshua, you may not take their land. I've given it to them. Land's a big deal to God, right? And it's not something that just changes hands easily, right? But David is taking land that isn't his. God promised him last chapter, I'm going to give you peace on all sides. Okay, so you got to be at peace with enemies. So maybe you go to battle with them. Eric?
Are they in the promised borders of Israel?
Yes. Yes and no. That's what's conflicting about it. Solomon takes a bunch of land. David takes land. And that boundary seems to kind of almost shift over time. It's just a weird deal.
Yeah, I was going to say, he didn't make an everlasting covenant with Joshua to never have anyone take the land. He just told Joshua to do it.
Possibly. So maybe it just applies to him. But man, it certainly is an everlasting covenant with Abraham, right? Are we talking about the land promise for Israel today? And God said, I'm going to give you this land. I mean, does God not want that anymore for his nation? Is that changed? I mean, it's just a bizarre deal. Yeah.
I should find where it is. But I remember that the Moabites did have, a curse on them. It said something like, to the 10th generation, they can't come into the assembly of God, because when the Israelites were coming out of Egypt, they didn't provide bread and water mm-hmm. for them. And so that's why Ruth being a Moabite is
yeah.
perfect, so.
There's certainly a yeah. I mean, they're enemies of Israel. They did not take care of them. You remember what? Yeah, they asked to basically cut through their land. Joshua did, and they said no, go around. And they came after them with swords, and Joshua was forced to kind of stand down. He wasn't even allowed to fight them, so they go around. So they were definitely turds to them. However, the king of Moab was like friendly to David. Yes, I'll take your family in, but now I'm going to kill 2/3 of your people, and put the rest of you to. It's an odd like. They helped you, man. They saved your bacon. You sent them tribute when you got on the throne to say thank you. Like you sent them a Christmas gift. And yet now you're going to, I'm conflicted about it, if you can't tell.
Do we know how much time has gone from, you know, David's further conquests, like what we're talking about right here, to when he was like seeking refuge in Moab before he became king?
Yeah, David's probably in his, he's middle of the way through his reign at this point. So, we don't have exact numbers on this, but we know when we hit chapter 11, David's 50. So he's probably in his 40s, his mid-40s. He's been on the throne now for a decade. So he was running when he was in his 20s. So, yeah, I mean, 10, 20 years. It's not like we're talking 100 years. So anyway, it's just an odd deal. So I don't know what to do with that. It seems like David is pushing boundaries and areas that are becoming gray, if you will. Maybe they're not black and white. Maybe they're not just like outright sin. But there's some gray areas that David's stepping into that are questionable. And we see that in a bunch of areas. And I'll point them out as we keep going. Okay. Now, is his heart gold? It seems like it. I mean, God says, man, I'm going to bless you and I'm taking care of you. Now, just keep looking through chapter 8. Let's kind of rewind the tape. So 8:2, we looked at Moab. 8:3, David defeated that dude, the son of Rechab, king of Zobah. He went to restore his rule over the river. David captured from him 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers. And some of these numbers may be a little bit different in your Bibles, depending on, there's some translation questions on the numbers themselves. But regardless, the meaning is the same. David hamstrung the chariot horses, but reserved enough for them 100 chariots. This is the first time we've seen this in Israel. What does David keep in 8 verse 4?
Horses.
Horses and what else? He hamstrung some of the horses, or maybe all of them, but he kept chariots. Who had chariots? Who was most notable for those? The Philistines, right? Why would David be keeping chariots? Come on, think like a king. Why would you keep chariots if you're a king?
Military,
they're powerful. They're good things to go do battle with, okay? Joshua, turn back real quick. I just want to show you some contrast in the midst of this. Joshua 11, verse 6.
The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, for tomorrow at this time I will give over all of them slain to Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire."
Verse 9.
Joshua did to them just as the Lord said to him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire.
Now, Joshua's in a very similar position, right? He's having to conquer a land. This is the northern conquest. These are big, strong, tough guys. They're in the middle of a battle. You've got a bunch of horses and a bunch of chariots available, and God tells them to do what? Destroy them all. Why?
Did he make a command not to keep wives, horses, or something else?
Yes. That's for the king specifically, so that's coming. That's Deuteronomy 17 from this point at least. Why would God tell them, hey, don't keep any of their instruments of warfare?
Because they put their trust in
them. Put the trust in that. Okay, what's David doing? Is this a different time? Yeah, maybe. Okay, but God said burn them. Okay, maybe that was just Joshua. Do you see the slippery slope that David's in? Well, I'm going to kill their horses but keep just 100 chariots, right? It's odd, okay? Back to 2 Samuel. When the Arameans of Damascus came to help King of Zobah, David killed 22,000 Arameans. Okay, David put garrisons in verse 6 among the Arameans of Damascus. So he's fighting now in modern-day Syria, Damascus. The Arameans became servants of David, bringing tribute. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. Okay, so maybe God is a fan of this. David took the shields in verse 7, which were carried by the servants of Hadadezer, and brought them to Jerusalem. took a very large amount of bronze in verse 8. Okay, you're seeing a list of all the places that David conquers. Okay, and at the end of it, in verse 14, the Lord helped David wherever he went. That's the second time in this text we've seen that. Verse 15, so David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and righteousness for all his people. So how is he doing as a king? It seems good, right? I mean, the people love him. God seems to be on his team. Like, these are great statements, but there's just, again, little pieces where I go, I don't quite know what to do with that. And there's enough of them where I go, man, I don't know, David. Okay? So that's the piece, okay? Joab, the son of Zeruiah, verse 16, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was his recorder. So he's got all these guys in his cabinet. Joab, we know. Jehoshaphat is his secretary. Zadok, the son of Ahiatub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. So what else has David instituted that we haven't seen in a while in 17? The priesthood is back, right? So we're at least having the right roles. David isn't both priest and king. He has priests, and he's beginning to transfer over the line from, you know, we saw Zadok mentioned in there that the kingdom would be transferred, the priestly kingdom would be transferred to him. Benaiah, who is bad. Benaiah is one of the most awesome dudes in your Bible. We'll get to him in chapter 23. He is one of David's chief guys and administers justice over warfare and other things, kind of similar to Joab, but he's over another band of people, okay? So if you just take a step back and you say, man, God's perspective on this sure seems to be great. David was promised peace by God in chapter 7. He has peace right now. Never before and never again will we see this. Literally, on every side of David, east, north, west, south, David has peace. We've never seen that, okay? Now, with that in mind, let's go back to the half-full version of David. Chapter 9 falls right into this, okay? This is my favorite chapter in all of Scripture, hands down. This chapter is the greatest example of grace, I would argue, in the entire Bible. I say that in hindsight, looking through the eyes of Jesus and understanding what this represents. But you're going to see a magnanimous heart in David. You're going to see graciousness beyond belief. You're going to see characters in the story that will blow your mind. It's amazing. So with this, at literally the height of his kingdom, right? David has land. He has money. He has power. He has peace. Notice what's on David's mind, okay? So is that as the backdrop? 2 Samuel 9, verse 1.
David said, is there anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?
All right. What is David thinking about right now? The death of Saul and Jonathan, okay? Which was, by the way, how long ago?
A decade.
Anyway, right? Who knows about this covenant that he made with Saul and Jonathan? Really nobody. I mean, nobody unless David's told folks, and they're both dead. Their sons are dead. Ishbosheth, Saul's only surviving son after that battle, is dead. So there's not a whole lot of people around, but what's David noodling on? What do you guess that word is, by the way, in verse 9, that he may show him kindness? That's the word hesed. Who can I be unconditionally gracious to? Who does not deserve the king's favor, who has not earned this right, who is around that I can just unconditionally bless? That's what David's asking. Now, for a guy who has everything at this point a king could want, he's got power, he's got wives, he's got money, he's got everything. Notice where his heart still is. Like, that's amazing. How can I be godly? How can I honor my word? How can I be like God to somebody else in a very positive, non-flamboyant way, if you will? He's asking who he can bless. Like, that is an amazing picture. Where do you guess most kings would be heart-wise at this point in their rule?
Prideful.
Yeah. How can I get more? How can I make this more about me? And David certainly has elements of that, right? He's got a city named after himself. He's taken a lot of things that maybe he shouldn't have. We don't know. But that's the idea, okay? Now, verse 2. David's going to take this beyond just a daydream of, man, I wonder if there's, you know, and he's going to put shoe leather on it.
And there was a servant of the house of Saul, whose name was Ziba. So when they had called him to David, the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, at your service. And the king said, is it not Is there still not someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness?
So he brings this guy, thanks Will, a guy named Ziba, Ziba, whatever his name is. And where does this guy come from, by the way? He's from whose house? Saul's house. Why would David have a guy from Saul's house around? A servant of Saul's house, specifically. It's brilliant, by the way. Why would he take someone from Saul's administration and bring them into his house? Favor, respect. Man, if you're new to the kingdom and you want to know everything that's happened before you, and where the cups are and who put the spoons where and whatever, who signed that document, who do you bring in? You bring in the dead CEO's secretary, like, because he or she knows everything, right? If Brad dies tomorrow, we should probably make Katrina the senior pastor of the Well Community Church because she knows everything, right? Everything, literally, right? So he's brilliant. This guy knows everything. So I don't know if there's someone around. Like, I haven't been, you know, this is new to me. So he's got a guy in Saul's kingdom that has literally all the answers to all the questions. So he's connected relationally. Do you know of anybody? Is there someone around that I can show kindness to? Okay. Now, Ziba is going to make kind of a fascinating, he's going to answer David. Just look at what he says. This is his answer midway through verse 3.
And Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet.
Okay, so what's his answer? Yeah, there is somebody. There's a guy. There's a son of Jonathan. So David gets the news that he's been asking for, right? That's what he was hoping for. He doesn't know. Now he finds out. Now, what does Ziba add? And better yet, why does he add this statement about this son of Jonathan? What does he say? He's crippled in his feet. Now, talk to me about why would Ziba say that?
He's no threat to you.
He's no threat to you, okay?
He's nobody.
He's a nobody. How is, unfortunately, maybe in this time, if you look at physical handicap and if you look at the requirements for a priest, could you be physically handicapped and be a priest? No. Couldn't. You couldn't have eczema, you couldn't have scars, you couldn't have, right? There's a whole list in Leviticus of normal stuff and some really weird stuff that we read as to what you could or could not be as a priest, right? I couldn't be a priest because I got two missing toes. Just, they wouldn't allow it, right? That's part of the requirement, okay? Ziba tells David, we've got a guy, but he's crippled in both feet. So possibly, half full version, he's not a threat to you. The half empty version is, man, he's a nobody. Now, why would Ziba be spent, where has Ziba spent his entire life? Serving, right? Is this a blue-collar job or a white-collar job? Serving the king. Dude, that is a white-collar job. He's been raised in the palace. He's been around noble things. He spent however long under Saul, maybe upwards of 40 years. Now he's 10, 15 years into David's reign, maybe further. Like, he's kind of a posh, like, I like my gig, I like my job. And this guy, he doesn't fit here. He doesn't belong here, okay? Now, that's what I see kind of going on. Now, turn back real quick to 2 Samuel verse 4. Let's find out actually how this happens because it's tragic. We skipped it as we were reading over. As the news comes that Saul and Jonathan specifically died in battle, and then more specifically in chapter 4 verse 1, when Ishbosheth, Saul's only remaining son, is murdered, once the line of Saul has officially been killed, word gets back in chapter 4, verse 4, to Jonathan's son. Okay, read chapter 4, verse 4 of 2 Samuel.
Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet.
Okay, same son that we're reading about in 2 Samuel 9. Okay?
He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled.
All right, stop right there. Okay? The news of Saul and Jonathan reached his nurse. This kid's 5 years old, okay? So he's not even in kindergarten yet, or maybe just thereabouts. And the news that Saul and Jonathan died has now come to her ears, or his ears, whoever the nurse is, probably a woman. And they fled. Why would they flee?
Thought they would kill him too.
Yeah, they thought, my life's over. Now, why would that be the natural assumption? That's what the king does. Look, you want to put down any future coups? Kill the line. So that's what they do. Does this guy have any no knowledge of maybe David and Jonathan's relationship. He has no knowledge of this, right? So he's fearful for his life, or at least his nurses, and they flee, okay? Haley, do you have a question? Mm-hmm. Okay. As they're fleeing, keep reading.
And his nurse took him up and fled, and as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame.
Okay. Literally falls, has an accident that brings this about. So this five-year-old was fine prior to this. They fall, and he now becomes lame. So he's somehow crippled in his leg. It's the word pika. It literally means to limp. So he's got some sort of now physical, permanent, what is the word I'm looking for?
Abnormality.
Thank you. Gosh, it would not come. So he's crippled, and he's had some life-changing situation that's caused this, okay? His name was Mephibosheth, okay? So say that 10 times fast. Mephibosheth, okay? His name literally means from the mouth of shame, okay? So he doesn't have a good legacy. Similar to Ishbosheth, it means like the sky is falling, basically. This is kind of a similar idea, right? The kid's name means from the mouth of shame. He's mentioned in another place in Scripture, all his names are bad. Meribaal, I believe, is his other name. Meribaal, which means Baal is my advocate, or Baal is my master. And it seems like his name was that. In 1 Chronicles, it speaks of this. And then it got changed to, or he's identified here in 2 Samuel as the mouth, from the mouth of shame. Why would you rename a kid, especially maybe in this context, whose new name means from the mouth of shame? How do you think Mephibosheth was viewed? Horrible, right? I mean, how would you like to have a name that is like a taunt, right? To be called cripple, or to be called not good enough, or to be called worthless, or to be called a scumbag. And that's kind of what he heard when his name was said. So this guy is viewed as shameful. He's viewed as less than. That's his life. And they're fleeing from the presence of David, right? Ultimately, the coming king. For fear of his life, fear that as a someone who's in the line of Saul, ultimately a son of Jonathan, a grandson of Saul, that his life was at stake. So this is the course of action that brings this poor kid to this state in his life. Okay, now David finds out, oh, there's a kid, and he is indeed alive, because Ziba, the know-it-all, knows all. Okay, verse 4, David's going to push the issue. Now I think Ziba, as a wise servant, pushes the issue a little bit, right? He can only say so much to the king. Yes, there's a son. He's crippled in both feet. David, read between the lines. Listen to what I'm saying without me having to say it, I think is what Ziba's doing. David pushes further. Verse 4, back to chapter 9 and verse 4.
So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Amiel, in Lo Debar.
Okay, he is on the east side of the Jordan River, so he has fled from his tribal allotment towns, right? He's from the tribe of Benjamin, as Saul would have been, as Jonathan is as well. Should have been living in the land, in his allotted land, but instead flees to Lo Debar. Lo Debar literally means barren place, so not any place we're going to go vacation in, right? It's hot, it's dry, it's in the Edom Mountains, or the Moab Mountains up there. It's not pleasant. So he's literally hiding in a desert land, okay? Probably in, not the Yeshimon, but probably a Siya, or at the very least, probably a Midbar, right? So he's in a desert, in a horrible place. And what's this kid's existence like, would you guess? What is his number one goal in life? Don't get killed. Don't get found out. Don't get caught by David. If I can live my life under the radar, have my nurse take care of me with my crippled issue or whatever, if I can just kind of ease under the radar, that's a good life. So his worst fear is what? By getting found out by David. Okay, so verse 4, the king said to him, "Where is he?" Meaning, I want him. Finds out he's in Lo Debar. David in verse 5 now sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lo Debar. Now imagine that scene, okay? David sends for this guy. So he sends some dudes, some cohort, to Lo Debar, to barren place, knocks on Mephibosheth's door, and Mephibosheth says, "Oh, hello, who are you guys? We're representatives of David. King David has sent us to get you, to bring you back to Jerusalem." All right, this is the part in the story where Mephibosheth wets his pants, okay? This is your worst nightmare, right? This is exactly what you do not want to hear. So Mephibosheth realizes, I've been found out. I'm not in hiding anymore. David knows who I am. He knows where I live, and he's here to get me, and you're going to go with the king, okay? Now, brings him back, okay, to the palace, apparently, okay? Pick up now in verse 6.
Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan and the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. And David said, Mephibosheth?
It's a mouthful.
So he said, here is your servant.
Now, walk me through the actions of Mephibosheth. What does he do when he realizes he's in the presence of King David? Now, more than likely, he's never even seen this guy his whole life, right? He doesn't never laid eyes on David. He's younger. Mephibosheth, by the way, is probably 25 at this point in his life. Okay, so he's been on the run for probably close to 20 years, hiding, right? How does he respond when he sees David? Humbly, okay? Why else would you fall on your face in front of a king?
Scared.
You're scared to death, right? You're begging for your life. Like, he's completely prostrate. He is face down in front of David. And is what do you think he's expecting next? I mean, what's more than likely, what's Mephibosheth thinking right now?
I'm dead.
The next thing I'm going to feel is a sword on the back of my neck, right? I'm going to get a talking to by David. What the heck? You dirty dog. You've been hiding. I'm going to kill you, right? That's, I think, probably more than likely what Mephibosheth is probably thinking is going to happen. Like, my life is over. David says, Mephibosheth, and he says, here is your servant, right? I'm not trying to start a coup. I'm just, right? He's doing everything he can. Now, verse 7, here's where it all changes.
So David said to him, do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually.
What? Time out. What's David's response? Not only are you not going to kill me immediately, but you're going to do what? You're going to show me, not kindness, you're going to show me chesed. You're going to show me grace beyond measure. You are going to give me what I do not deserve, what I have not earned, what I could not pay you for, what I couldn't barter for. I have nothing to give to you, yet you're just going to unconditionally bless me and give me all this. First of all, I will surely show you kindness for whose sake? Your father. What is David thinking of at this point?
The covenant.
I made a covenant with your dad. You don't know the significance of our relationship, but I gave him my word, and not just my word, and not just a promise. I covenanted before him and him before me that regardless of what would happen, I would show kindness to Jonathan's house and ultimately back it up to Saul's house. And I'm a man of my word. That does not break just because Saul's dead and Jonathan's dead. I will show you kindness because of your father and I's relationship. Not only that, what else does he get? I will give you all the land. You're living in Lodabar. Dude, you're living in like Turlock. I'm going to bring you back in to, you're going to live in the land of Benjamin, where your fathers are, where Saul is buried and Jonathan is buried, your tribal allotment given by God. I'm going to restore to you not just your tribal lands, but what would have Saul have had, by the way, as the king of Israel? Yeah, he'd have Clovis, right? He'd had land, right? He'd had plenty. So I'm going to give you your grandfather's inheritance. You're going to live in this land, right? You guys remember, we haven't read about him yet. Sorry, this is in Israel. We're going to read about a guy named Naboth, right? And he has a vineyard that this pagan king wants to take over, Ahab. And he says, man, no, that's my land. Get your own land, right? But land's important to these to this group of people. So he's going to restore his grandfather's land, his house. I mean, that's a big deal, okay? And what else? This is what is above and beyond. David didn't have to do this.
Verse 8, right?
No, end of verse 7.
You shall
eat at my table regularly. Interpret that for me. What does that mean?
You're living with me.
You're part of my family. You are my... Son, I'm adopting you. You will eat at my table. You are part of my family. Okay? Who ate at David's table? His wives, right? Okay? But Adonijah, Solomon, Absalom, Tamar, probably Joab, maybe Abishai, maybe some of the warriors that were there, his confidants, the people that he trusted the most. But these are his people. This is his inner circle, and this is his family. David is saying to Mephibosheth, not only am I not going to kill you, I'm adopting you. I'm your father. I will bring you in. Your dad's dead. Your grandfather's dead. I'm taking you in, and I will care for you. You're going to get land. You're going to get stuff, and you're going to be my son. Like, do you guys see the picture of David's heart in this moment? It's amazing. Now, again, you can imagine that Mephibosheth's world in a verse just got completely turned upside down. Look at verse 8 and listen to his response.
Then he bowed himself and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dog as I?"
Okay, put that in Living Bible for me. What did Mephibosheth just say? Yeah, I'm not worthy. What the heck? Excuse me? Like, I'm a dead dog. David said that to Saul. I'm a dead dog. I'm a single flea. Like, why are you pursuing me, Saul? Like, this is what he's saying. I'm a nobody from nowhere, and I just want to die and not be caught by you. Like, what are you doing? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, he can't put the pieces together. And this is so mind-blowing for him. He can't reconcile all that's going on. Now, to up the ante, watch what David does again. Verse 9.
And the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "I have given to your master's son all that belongs to Saul and to his house. You, therefore, and your sons and your servants shall work the land for him. You shall bring in the harvest that your master's son may have food to eat."
Okay, pause right there. So what does he say to Ziba?
"You're in charge of the
land. You're in charge of his land. All that belonged to Saul specifically is now Mephibosheth's. And what else does Mephibosheth get? Because he's lame and can't work. You get Ziba, and you get servants." Okay, so Ziba, who kind of made a snide remark, I think, earlier, and David heard it that way, he's crippled in both feet. Like, you don't want this guy. David says, you're going to get to be his chief servant. You're going to tend the fields for him. You're going to bring in the harvest. And he's showing Mephibosheth, look, I'm not just saying I'm going to restore you. I'm not just putting you at my table. I'm giving you all of your grandfather's land. I am blessing you beyond belief, and you're going to have all of this land that is rightly due to you. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson shall eat at my table regularly. I'm not pushing him off into his own father's land, and he gets to live in Benjamin while I live in the palace in Jerusalem. He's saying, no, you're a son to me. Now, all that land is yours, but you are now going to eat at my table regularly, the second time that we see that. Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants that, by the way, are all now Mephibosheth's, given by David. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands, his servant to his servant, your servant will do." Okay, so Ziba says, okay, you stated clearly, David, that's what we're going to do. So Mephibosheth ate at King David's table as one of the king's sons, and you hear it specifically mentioned there, okay? Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, so old enough, obviously, to have a son, and all who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly. Now he was lame in both feet. Do you think that, by the way, had to be a little bit intimidating to sit at David's table with the stature and quality of people that sat around that table as a guy that was lame in both feet? And how does David treat Mephibosheth? He's an equal, right? He looks over his deformities. He covers that, obviously, even at the table, which is kind of a cool picture. From the waist upward, he would have looked just like everybody else. And David takes care of this guy. Now, this is a powerful story, and you guys can see why. This is a perfect illustration of grace. It's the same picture that we, as sons and daughters of another king, receive. There's nothing we can do to earn, nothing we can do to deserve it. There's nothing we can do to pay it back. There's nothing we could have done to pay it for it in the beginning. But Jesus bestows upon us sonship and daughtership, if you will. And we are adopted into the family of God, right? That is the overwhelming picture here. We are all Mephibosheth, right? We all are in that position. Mephibosheth, unlike some others, understands his own depravity. He understands where he came from and how little he deserves. I don't know if you guys have friends like that that have lived maybe more difficult lives. Like, everyone's got a bit of a different way that they end up getting to the foot of the cross. Some see some holes, if you will, seem a little deeper than others. I've got a buddy that, I mean, when you listen to his story, it's horrific, right? And I know some of your stories in here, and some of them are frankly horrible. And what you went through, what you had to experience, some of that was self-inflicted, some of that was victimization from other people that you experienced through no fault of your own. But when we receive grace, I think even more specifically for people who have kind of self-destructed their own lives, have an understanding of how deep that hole was that God had to reach and pull them out of, right? I got a buddy like that, and I think that's Mephibosheth. And he, at this point, is very downwind of himself, right? He realizes the funk and the disgust and everything that grows on a guy and what he could not get on his own. David had to extend this as a free gift, all right? So that is why I love this guy so much. Now, thankfully, his story doesn't end here, okay? So I don't like to do this often, but for the sake of Mephibosheth, I will. We're going to fast forward in the story a little bit because I want to show you the rest of where we see this guy. We only see him two other places in Scripture. We don't see him in Chronicles. A lot of these other stories are tied into other places where Ezra records them in the book of Chronicles. We don't see him in other places, okay? So I want you to turn now to 2 Samuel 16, and I'm going to, you know, ruin the what's coming. But as you guys know, David's going to sin, chapter 11, the Bathsheba thing's coming, the Uriah the thing is coming. At this point in the story, Absalom, one of David's sons, revolts, and we'll look through the story, and it affects Mephibosheth. And basically, David has a choice to make. Do I stand up to my son, who is basically bringing a military coup against me, his dad, and we'll find out why that happens maybe tomorrow, or do I just say, you know what? I'm not going to fight my son. If God wants me to have this throne, he'll let me have the throne. And that's ultimately the decision David makes. He leaves peacefully, and he walks out of Jerusalem. And he just says, you know what? It's not worth killing my son or these people or dividing Israel over it. If God is sovereign and he wants me on this throne, God gave it to me. God took it away. God can give it back. Okay? 16 verse 1, David is now leaving town. Okay? So he's walking out of the kingdom, basically handing it over to Absalom, who's had a He's got a wicked heart and is trying to take over in his father's place. Okay? 16:1, read that.
When David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him there, met him with a couple of saddle donkeys and on them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, and 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine.
Okay. So by the way, David is heading east out of Jerusalem, over the Mount of Olives, into the same wilderness that Jesus would have been tempted in, the same wilderness that we saw from the top of Qumran, okay? Horrible place, okay? And who meets him on his way out of town? Ziba. Why would Ziba do that? Yeah, he sent him. He knows David, right? He's been loyal to David, and he gives him basically a bunch of stuff. Like, dude, you're about to go on a miserable journey. Here's food, here's water, here's everything that you could possibly need. I'm going to hook you up as best I can, okay? And the king asks a very logical question in verse 2. David.
And the king said to Ziba, what do you mean to do with these?
Keep going.
So Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. The bread and the summer fruits are for the young men to eat, and the wine are for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink.
Okay, so I'm providing for you. Now, what else is Ziba saying behind the scenes? There's a coup being brought into Jerusalem. David's getting kicked out. What is Ziba saying? My loyalty is with you, okay? I realize that my actions right now could potentially cost me my life. I am being externally loyal to you. Everyone sees this. I'm giving you donkeys and stuff and food. This isn't secretive, right? And David now asks another question in verse 3.
Then the king said, where is your master's son?
Who is your master's son? Who are we speaking of? Mephibosheth. Where is Mephibosheth? I'm leaving town. You've come out to help me. Where's Mephibosheth? Behold, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. What does that mean? Yeah, Eric, you said it right. That is double middle finger to David. Screw you. Good riddance. The kingdom that my father, my grandfather Saul had is now being restored to me rightfully as it should have been. Screw you, good riddance. Wow. That's what, after David has done for Mephibosheth, that is Mephibosheth's response to unconditional grace, to this benevolent, amazing life that he now has, the grace that he's been given. This is how he treats his father. Good riddance. And just like Absalom is now doing to David, Mephibosheth is doing the same. So David's like, wow. Okay, so what do you say at this point? So David says to Ziba, verse 4.
Here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours.
So what's the promise here? All that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. What does that mean?
If David becomes king again, he's given all the land over.
Not even that, not even if. David's still king, kind of. All that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. Look, Mephibosheth obviously doesn't want in this family. He obviously doesn't care about me. This isn't what he wants. So we've got this issue of Saul's land. All the sons are dead. You're my Eleazar. You're the chief servant. So take all of his land. All of it is yours. So you can have, I guess, all of it. So, and David goes on his merry way, and the rest of the text continues that he's leaving land. This is the last interaction he has, and at least in this conversation with Ziba. And Mephibosheth has given him the double bird as he's walking out of town. I mean, are y'all a little frustrated? Like, can you believe the audacity of this punk that he would respond to grace that way? That he would be so disdainful of David's relationship with him and the sacrifice that he made to not understand the significance of what happened and to be thinking only about the kingdom and what's in it for me and what do I get out of this? Like, gosh, this guy's he's a turd. I mean, he's like king of turds. This is horrible, okay? Now, fast forward again, we see one other picture of Mephibosheth, okay? Now, coup gets put down. We'll discuss that later. David gets brought back into town, okay? So Absalom is dealt with. Turn to chapter 19, verse 24. And let's read the Paul Harvey rest of the story, okay? David is coming back into town. He's dealing with all this coup. He's administering justice. He's trying to be as gracious as he can. 19, verse 24.
Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king.
Oh, whoa. Now what's Mephibosheth doing? Who's been put down? Did he get the throne?
No.
Nope. What's he doing now? He's trying to save face, right? He's coming back to David and saying, hey, here's what he's going to say.
And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, or washed his clothes for the day of the king departed until the day of his return in peace.
Wait a second. I thought Mephibosheth gave him the double bird. What is this a sign of? What does this mean? He had not cared for his feet, okay, which... that's a big deal when you're crippled in both feet. Hadn't washed his clothes, hadn't trimmed his mustache from the day the king departed until the day now the king came back. He's in mourning. All the external signs about Mephibosheth say, I'm wrecked. I'm in mourning. I am treating David as if he has died. And I am heartbroken over this, right? And everything externally would say something very differently than what David heard from Ziba. That something had transpired here that was maybe different. That Mephibosheth had said, the heck with you. That's at least the report he got from Ziba. Verse 25, it was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? That's a very logical question. Look, you look like you're in mourning, and if that was the case, and if you're still loyal to me, which that's what you're saying, but now I've got a conflicting story, then why didn't you come with me when I left town? Adolf read 26. Here's his answer.
So he answered, O my lord, the king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king, because your servant is lame.
Okay, so what is his response? My servant deceived me. Who is my servant? Ziba. Ziba deceived me. And what did Ziba say? I'll get a donkey ready. I'll get all the stuff to David on your behalf, Mephibosheth. I will send him a gift and make sure that he knows that you guys are good. And what did Ziba do? He lied. He said, oh, David, yeah, this is all from my hand to bless you. And boy, I'm sorry about this. Where's Mephibosheth? Oh, he gave you the double bird. Well, Mephibosheth's just saying, look, I'm crippled in both feet. My servant is going to give these on my behalf. I can't leave town. I'm not able to do that. So what do I do? 26. Oh, my Lord, the king, my servant, deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle the donkey. Did we just read that? Because your servant is lame, and I will go with the king because your servant is lame. 27, moreover, he has slandered your servant, my lord, to the king. But my lord, the king, is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is right in your sight. So Mephibosheth says, no, look, I'm still loyal to you. Ziba lied to you. Now, what's the problem if you're David? Who do you believe? Ziba, who's been loyal to Saul, but then apparently for years in your kingdom has been loyal to you? Or do you believe Mephibosheth? Do you believe what you see with your eyes, that he's in mourning? And maybe he is, or maybe he just doesn't like to take baths. I don't know. Like, you look like you're in mourning, and you're saying it's about this. Maybe it's about another thing, right? I don't know. So David's stuck. Now, the decision that David's about to make drives me absolutely crazy, and it's absolutely brilliant at the same time, okay? He's going to find out. This is going to be, you're about to get a glimpse of where Solomon gets his wisdom, right? You remember the story of Solomon where two people come to him? We'll read about it later on in 2 Kings, two mothers. Hey, this is my baby. No, that's my baby. Well, no, you rolled over on your baby in the middle of the night and killed your baby, and you took my baby. And Solomon says what? Cut the baby in half and give each a part. And what did he do that for? He knew that the real mother would say, oh, no. Give the whole baby to the other woman. I would rather the whole baby live, right, my baby, than half the baby live with me. So, and Solomon realized that and said, that's the real mother, okay? David is about to pull a Solomon before there was a pulling of a Solomon, okay? Where are we? 28, read that. This is still Mephibosheth talking, by the way.
28.
Is that where we left off? Yes, please, 28. All right, so what is Mephibosheth saying here?
You saved me.
What event is he thinking about? 2 Samuel 9. Like, you, in a moment's time, gave me grace that was so unexpected, so overwhelming, that so wrecked me. What else do I have to say to you, David? Nothing else matters. I sit at your table. I'm your son. Now, how can Mephibosheth prove that to David? What can he do to say, no, this is true. I'm not lying. This is what means the world to me. He's in a tough spot, right? He's in a jam. Now, David's going to make him. So the king said to him, why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land. Now, why does David do this? He doesn't know if he's telling the truth, so why would this be important?
Because if is telling the truth, he'll be okay with dividing the land because he's just happy that David's back.
If the most important thing is being a son to the king, then the land doesn't matter. It's just, all that's peripheral. It's just stuff. The relationship with you is what matters to me. Now, if that's not what's really in Mephibosheth's heart, and he wants all the accoutrements and all the decorations that come with being the king's son, then he's going to be really hacked that he gets this, frankly, really crummy deal, right? Watch his response. This is what makes me love this guy. Verse 30.
Mephibosheth said to the king, rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house.
What does he say? Ziba can have all of it. I don't care about the land. I want you. You have returned. You are my father. I am a son to you, and that is the most important thing in my life. So do you see how David played that out, right? And I think this is such a beautiful example of our salvation and what we put on esteem, right? What we put on high. John Piper, in a book, wrote it, and I think it was so eloquent. He said, man, if you can picture heaven, and when you close your eyes and you think about what it's going to be like when we die, and you think of golden roads, or right when I was a kid riding four-wheelers in the clouds, like that was heaven to me. I don't know why. That was just like the greatest thing ever. I didn't have a motorcycle, so one day in heaven, that's what I'm going to get to do, right? All the things that you think about when you think about the greatness of heaven and riches and no more tears and all that stuff. He said, if you can think of all that stuff and that picture for you is absent of God, then you have a wrong picture of heaven. The greatest thing that we get as Christians is God. That is our reward. That is the thing that we put our most hope in. That is the thing that we are supposed to say, nothing else matters. And I think Mephibosheth, like nobody else, gets that picture. The greatest reward for me, David, is you, because I am your son. And because of the depth of the depravity that God had to pull him out of, he gets that. And he never loses sight of what his life was like before David, and now what his life is like after David. Are you with me? He gets grace like nobody gets grace. Now, I wish David would have given him all the land. I wish he wouldn't divide it in half. I don't know. I don't know that it was just, David may have just been mad and made a quick, like, screw it all, divide it in half. I don't want to deal with this, right? And he's had to deal with a lot of other people on the way back in from his coup that have been turds, and he's having to deal with them. So I think he's kind of a little bit emotionally shot. He's probably hungry, whatever, right? But regardless, it may be a brilliant decision by David. Again, welcome to my torn life with David. I don't know how to view him. But regardless, Mephibosheth is one of my heroes. I cannot wait to meet this guy in heaven, because he gets grace like I think so few of us really get grace, because he understands how little he brought to the equation, right? He brought sin, and that was it. And in the equation of God, his Father, saving him, that's all he brought. And he gets that. And for the rest of his life, he lives in light of that moment and that day, and he never forgets the grace extended to him. So years and years later, as David is thrown out of the kingdom, the land doesn't matter, the stuff doesn't matter. He still has all that stuff, by the way. And how does he live his life while David's gone? He's in mourning. He's a wreck. He doesn't care about any of it. So he is probably second to Jesus, if I had to qualify that. My favorite character in Scripture, because he just gets it. And the further, to be completely honest with you guys, the further I get away from the cross, the harder and harder it is for me to remember this, to realize the grace that was bestowed upon me, to not feel, to remember that moment and to remember why I live and what God did. That was 20 plus years ago for me in my rearview mirror. And I just appreciate a guy like this who never forgets that and never lives his life in a way that's different. Okay? Some of your stories lend themselves to this, and you never... like Mephibosheth, get over that, right? You never get over that moment. And I think for others of us that maybe lived more, squeaky clean is the wrong word, right? But you know what I mean? That just didn't do anything like obnoxiously stupid that maybe it's harder for us to realize that. And I think that's why I like this guy so much. So just to tie a bow on Mephibosheth, thoughts on him before we kind of move back into David's life? He's just a neat dude. All right, learn how to say his name. You're going to have to meet him in heaven, okay? There's other dudes that you can forget about, but this guy, you need to shake his hand, give him a hug, and say thank you that you got it and you're helping me get it, okay? And then get out of line, because I want to give him a hug too. All right, so back to 2 Samuel 9, okay? So we see this beautiful story of grace bestowed to this guy, and again, at the height of David's kingdom, you're getting a bit of insight into what's going on in this guy's heart, which is magnificent to me. You just don't see this from any other king in Israel, okay? Now, chapter 10, more on battles that David's fighting, okay? It happened afterwards that the king of the Ammonites died, and Hunan, or whatever this guy's name is, in chapter 10, verse 1, became king in his place. So the Amorites have a new king. David said, I will show kindness to this dude, right? He's had a relationship with Ammon. The son of Nahash. Nahash was the guy that was a turd. His name means snake, right? You guys remember that story with Jabesh, Gilead, and those men that rescued Saul's body. Nahash was the guy that was a part of that, that attacked this town that Saul saved, and David honors these men for saving his body. David even has intentions to being honorable and noble to his enemies, right? So he wants to bestow grace upon this guy. And apparently Nahash was kind to him in verse 2. So David sent servants to console him concerning his father. But when David's servants came to the land of Ammon, the Ammonites across the Jordan, the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanan, their lord, "Do you think that David is honoring your father because he has sent consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants in order to search the city, to spy it out and to overthrow it?" So David sends people to say, "Hey, listen, get him a card from Hallmark, get him some roses, and say, man, we're real sorry about what happened to your dad. We feel terrible." And how do his counselors view this action? The king's counselors, what do they say? These guys aren't consolers. What are they?
Spies.
Dude, they're spies. Like, they're tricking you. You're an idiot, okay? And this is the advice that he now takes, okay? Verse 4, read that.
"So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips and sent them away."
Okay, so he shaves off half their beard, right? Half their face. So that had to look pretty weird. I don't know if you've ever seen a half beard. I never have, but that's got to be interesting. Why would you say shave someone's half their face, by the way?
Shame them.
To shame them. Why specifically? In Israel, but why would that be shameful?
You weren't supposed to cut your beard.
Yeah. The side growth of your beards, you weren't supposed to trim. So this was dishonoring. Now, what do they have to do? They got to shave the rest of it off, or they've got to wait till this side catches up with this side, right? So they're going to get exiled, which is what's going to happen, so their beards can grow back. So it's a double punking. So now you got to choose. Are you going to shave the rest of it off so you don't look like an idiot and further shame yourself? Or are you just going to live like a doofus, right? Look, I have a beard. Oh, no, I don't. Right? And that's, David recognizes that and basically says, man, we'll put you somewhere else until you're unshameful, okay? And then cuts half their clothes off, right? It makes them walk home shirtless, basically, okay? When David hears of it, he's rightly mad, okay? Because he's trying to be gracious, and his act of grace is interpreted as an act of, like, treason, basically. The men were greatly humiliated in verse 5, and the king said, "Stay in Jericho until your beards grow, and then return." So stay there, and then come back later. Now, verse 6, this is what David does.
"When the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, the Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men."
So this guy's smart. Like, oh, this didn't go as we planned. David's actually really mad. So now he goes and hires men to fight with him. Tob is where Jephthah was from, one of the judges on the east side of the Jordan. So these guys aren't necessarily friendly, but they're soldiers for hire. So he gets a bunch of soldiers in. David heard of it. He sent Joab and all the army and the mighty men. He's like, all right, you want to fight? We're going to fight because you've dishonored me. You've dishonored my men. Verse 8, keep going, Max.
"And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. When Joab saw that the battle was set against him, both in front and in the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. The rest of his men he put in the charge of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the Ammonites."
All right, so basically they're surrounded. He divides Joab divides their forces into different companies. Abishai, who's his brother, we've heard about Abishai before, takes a company and basically says, man, we're going to fight on our front. If we get overwhelmed, you come help us. Vice versa, if you get overwhelmed, we'll come help you. Verse 13, "Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, and they fled before him." So we're going to see that Israel ultimately is going to take the day. Verse 17, "Now it was told to David that he gathered all of Israel together. They crossed the Jordan. All the Arameans arrayed themselves to meet David and fought against him. Verse 18, "But the Arameans fled before Israel. David killed 700 charioteers, the Arameans, 40,000 horsemen, and struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there." So this is a big battle that Joab, along with David now, and Abishai win. Verse 19, "When all their king's servants of Hadadezer and saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Arameans feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. Okay, so David is literally now, at this point, put down all of the enemies. So he's peace on all sides. He's been gracious to Mephibosheth. God is helping him on every front. We are in Camelot. Okay, now with that in mind, chapter 11 is where it all goes south. This is where Camelot ends drastically. Okay, David is 50 years old at this point, so he's not an old man, but he's not a young man. Okay, he ain't a spring chicken anymore. And he's realizing that, man, I've been ruling now for 20 years on the throne. He's got another 20 in front of him, but he's aging. Okay, 11 verse 1, you guys know this story. Let's just walk through it, and I would love to hear some observations, honest observations, guys and gals, okay, as we read this story. We stood, by the way, in Israel at this place where this would have occurred. And it's kind of fascinating to see the topography to understand what's going on. So let's pick it up in 11 verse 1. And this is the story of David and Bathsheba.
It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when the kings went out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all of Israel. And they destroyed destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem.
Okay, so what's going on in 11:1?
Sends out people to go do war,
right? Joab, Old Faithful, right? He's a machine. He sends him out to go do war in the spring. That would have been a normal thing. And, you know, David's conquering more land or whatever, right? Because God's hands on him and he's with him, okay? What's going on with David?
He's chilling at home,
right? Man, this thing's on autopilot. I'm going to stay home. Joab's got it handled. Part of you go, okay, you're 50. Do you need to be going to battles anymore? Maybe not. Maybe it's better for you to be king, and it's more important for you not to die in the battlefield. I don't know, but whatever. So maybe there's some laziness there. Maybe there's some, just kind of resting on your laurels, if you will, and your previous success, and let's send Joab and get it done. Okay, but David stays in Jerusalem. Now, verse 2, it just so happens.
Then it happened one evening that David arose from bed and walked to the roof of the king's house.
Okay, now pause there for a second. Jerusalem is a very hilly city, right? The portion where David lives is called the Old City. All of Jerusalem that is today isn't built, but David had a small portion of that city. And he literally lived on Mount Moriah, okay, on a large hill where Abraham would have ascended to sacrifice Isaac. It's a large hill with a peak of it at the top. David lives on that, okay? So as the king, just like you would think today, like if you have a 90-story building, you don't live on the second floor as the king. You live on the top. You live in the penthouse. David lived at the top where you can see everything in front of you, okay? So you've got the Kidron Valley between you that went up to the other side of the Mount of Olives. Houses everywhere. So David can see his kingdom. So when he walks on his roof, which is where, you know, we would walk in the cool of the day. That's where the restrooms were. That's where you kept your hobby or whatever. That's where David is. So he's just out walking around on his roof, okay? Nothing out of the ordinary thus far, okay? Okay, pause. Okay, so David is on his roof, and what does he see? Woman bathing in someone. Okay, which again, that would have been a normal place to bathe, would have been on your roof. That's not abnormal. Okay, so situationally, it's okay. Some have mentioned, some college students are like, man, why is he getting out of bed in the middle of the evening? He was probably taking a nap. Okay, so he probably didn't sleep all day. Right, he probably took an afternoon nap, and he's getting up, and you know, it's the middle of the late afternoon, evening's coming, and he gets up. Now, what does David see? He sees this woman, right, who's bathing. Now, modesty, even more so in this culture, David's culture, is way more significant than in our culture, right? We don't live in a very modest culture. We're not that way. In this culture, it was everything, okay? So talk to me about this woman. Gals, put yourself in her position. Do you think if you're this gal that you know a little bit about what's going on, is she completely innocent in this? I don't think so, okay? Now, I don't excuse David or his actions, but I think sometimes we paint this as a very one-sided story, as if David just inquires of this gal, that she's like, oh, I had no idea that he was interested in me. What is she doing? Ladies, let me hear from you. What is she doing? Yeah. So what is she doing? Yeah, she's putting herself out there. She probably has an idea that David's seen her before. They've probably had some type of previous interaction. He saw his eyes linger on her just a little bit too long, right? She knows, I think, what's going on, right? So he sees her bathing. And this is the point where David's got a decision to make, okay? If this is completely innocent and David's like, oh, dang, okay, there's a naked woman. Crap. Now I'm going to go back inside, okay? That, you know, you can't fault David for that. If that was genuinely the case, so I'm just walking on the roof of my tower and there's a gal that, boy, we just happened to cross paths at the wrong moment, okay? Go back in and be done with it, okay? David doesn't do that. What does he do? Read verse 3. And by the way, she's not ugly, okay, in case you're wondering, right? The text tells us that. So there, she knows that. He knows that.
And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?
Okay, so pause there for a second. So he goes, and now what does he do?
He asks about her.
What's going on within David's heart? Talk to me about James chapter 1. What has sin done at this point in David? It's taken over. David has already committed adultery here. Not physically, but where has he committed adultery? He's already given permission in his mind, and he's already given permission in his heart. Now it's just a matter of everything playing out and the event happening. Are you with me? He's already done it. He's already said, I'm not going to walk by the Spirit. I'm going to walk by the flesh, and I'm going to gratify the desires of my flesh. He's already walked through that whole process, and you guys know exactly what I'm talking about in your own lives. We all have our Bathshebas, right? Our issues that we wrestle with, and we know that there is a point, there's a fork in the road when we hit those, when we say, Lord, I'm either going to choose to walk with you and abide by the Spirit and not let sin have a foothold, or I'm going to walk by the flesh and I'm going to give it permission. David's already past that. Now, it's just a matter of this point of the story playing itself out and it going down that road. Okay, so I have those issues. Y'all have those issues. David had those issues. Thank God there's still people in the Bible that have those issues or we'd all feel like scumbags, right? So, yeah.
Does her name Bathsheba sound like Bath in their language?
No. Bet means house, and I don't know if that's Bath is house or not, but no, I don't think so.
So did we get the word Bath from her name?
No. No. That would be pretty horrible. So, yeah. No, that is not where we got it from, okay? Now, notice this servant's response, okay? What do you notice about that? And he said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, okay, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? When you speak of genealogies in Scripture, how do they work? Son of, right? This is Mike, son of Dan, whatever, right? That's how I would be identified. My dad's name is Dan, and I'm Mike, son of Dan. Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam? Okay, that's her dad. The wife of Uriah the Hittite. Is that genealogy? No. Why is that mentioned? Why does David's servant say, David, that's so-and-so, so-and-so's daughter, so-and-so's wife. That's Uriah the Hittite's wife.
I kind of get it, like, don't you already know this? Because, like, the way I see it is David, like, Uriah is one of David's mighty men. Like, it's not like Uriah is not unknown to
Absolutely.
David at all.
He knows Uriah.
And it's like, I mean, at least in my Bible, it's like his servant is questioning David going, don't you know who this is, like, already?
Okay, maybe.
I think he's giving him an opportunity to not pursue his lust.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Does he know Uriah? Without a shadow of a doubt. Uriah is one of David's 30. Okay, he has 30 mighty men. So of David's, like, best dudes, Joab, Abishai, Benaiah, Uriah is mentioned in that group in 2 Samuel 23. He is bad. He is trusted. He is close to David. Okay, this is not some unknown dude. Now, does he know Uriah's wife? I don't know. I don't think so. I think he saw her. I think he thinks she's hot. I think she is like, that wouldn't suck. That's the king. Where's my husband? Oh, he's on the battlefield with Joab. Lonely, boy, his eyes lingered on me. And I think that's why this is said. David has given an out here. Do you know who this is? This isn't just, as if this is better, some single woman. Okay? This is a married woman. And not just any married woman. David, this is the wife of Uriah the Hittite, your boy, right? This is a big deal. Okay? So I think that's exactly why it's mentioned. Now, the servant can't, I think, like Ziba, say it any stronger, right? In a, this is a positive rebuke. Ziba's was a bit negative. Yeah, he's crippled in both feet. Get the hint, David. He's saying, hey, get the hint, David. This is Uriah the Hittite's wife. Okay? David walks past that. Again, the sin has already occurred in David's heart. He's already given himself permission. So this rebuke was another checkpoint in the road. And now it's public. Now there's others that know about the intention of his heart, if you will. Okay? David sent messengers and took her. And when she came to him, he lay with her. And when he purified, and sorry, when she purified herself from her uncleanliness, she returned to her house. This is mutual. This is consensual. They are both willing participants in this act. He sends servants to her door. David wants to see you. She's not surprised. She's not unwilling to go. She is full on complicit in this whole thing. Okay? She knows what's coming and where it's going. He knows what's coming and where it's going. They commit the act in verse 4. Purifies herself, okay, just like you would according to Levitical law. So it's, again, not, this is what's fascinating. There isn't a complete abandonment of godliness, right? She's still concerned about Levitical impurity and cleansing myself and walking according to what the law says, but I am going to sleep with someone else's wife, or husband, rather, okay? So, like, it's an odd deal. Again, that's always the trick of sin. It's never in a complete abandonment of, like, that's not Satan's strategy. It's just a small twist. Did God really say that you would surely die? Is that what he said, Eve? Notice, by the way, tell me if this sounds familiar. In verse 2, David saw. Verse 3, he inquired. Verse 4, took. Is that not the same process of 2 John or 1 John? No, 2 John 2:16, is that what it is? Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, boastful pride of life. It's the same process that Adam went through, that Eve went through. I saw the fruit. It was pleasing to my eyes. I saw that it was good, and I took it, right? It's just it's the exact same progression. Sin 2,000 years later, 3,000 years later from the garden has not changed. And in our day and age, it has not changed. It's the same process. We see something with our eyes, in this case, something physical, and we make a choice at that moment to say, which path are we going to go down? God, am I going to walk in the spirit or walk in the flesh? Had David seen a naked woman and said, oh, dang, Gina. Okay, that was, okay. I'm gonna go back inside right now. Has David sinned? I would argue no. Like, does that happen, right? Where you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, of maybe no fault of your own, assuming the best with David, and something comes across your eyes. And you say, you know what? Whatever it may be, pick what it is. And if he chose to walk away from that, he's done no wrong. He's walked in obedience. Now, he may have saw something that he wished he could unsee or doesn't want to see, but if he responded in obedience, he could have walked away. But he walks down that path, okay? And that's the process of sin with him, and it's the same process with sin with you and I. So as I look at this story, there are two very complicit people in this. Bathsheba had the ability to say no, maybe less so, because this is the king inquiring of you, so I get that. You know, there's probably a piece where you're like, oh gosh, David wants me, and even if she wanted to say no, could she? I think she wanted to say yes the whole time, okay? So as we look at this, I see two people that are both very much guilty of their own unfolding of this sin, okay? And in verse 5 now, David is going to get the worst news that a guy that's trying to hide in his sin could possibly get.
Told David that I'm with child.
Now, what's David's problem? Yeah, there's no hiding this anymore, right? Right now it's me, it's Bathsheba and my servant and the dudes that went down to get Bathsheba, right? I can keep them quiet. Bathsheba's now with child. 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, it's going to be very apparent that she's with child. And what's her problem? Where's her husband? Oops. Now we've got to make a choice. And David's sin is about to snowball. In order to cover his sin, instead of confessing his sin, he's going to continue to walk down that road, and he's not going to realize what started as just a very small, potentially innocent glance is now going to completely blow up in his face, and he's going to lose an entire kingdom over it. Now, if you would have rewound the tapes and said, David, let me show you the consequences of your actions and where this is going to go. You're going to sleep with another dude's wife. You're going to murder him. You're going to cover that up. Your son, as a result, is going to rebel. One of your sons is going to rape one of your daughters because of your lack of control over this situation and others, and because of your own funk that you're dealing with as a result of this situation. He's going to raise up and start a coup. He's going to die because of that. And you with me? And unfold that. What choice do you think David would have made? Right. What are we all blinded to in the midst of our own sin? We never think about the consequences. And that is the most difficult thing to do. I think if David would have had the ability to walk down that road and say, man, this is where this is going to end up, that hour, whatever, of pleasure and self-gratification of my flesh, maybe it's not worth it. But he doesn't, and we don't either. Okay, so we'll see that unfold tomorrow. So more on David and Bathsheba and the ramifications of that, but this is where things go south in a hurry. Okay, so enjoy that happy little note. And see you guys in the morning.